The primary ballots are set and the campaigns are picking up steam. Who has the upper hand? We get analysis from two gentlemen who know the parties and candidates well, Republican Craig Robinson and Democrat Pat Reinhard, on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation, the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
I'm a dad.
I am a mom.
I'm a kid.
I'm a kid at heart.
I'm a banker.
I'm an Iowa banker.
No matter who you are, there is an Iowa banker who is ready to help you get where you want to go. Iowa Bankers, allowing you to discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks.
For decades, Iowa Press has brought you politicians and newsmakers from across Iowa and beyond, now celebrating more than 40 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa Public Television. This is the Friday, April 13 edition of Iowa Press. Here is David Yepsen.
We're just over a month and a half away from the June primaries. Democrats are trying to take advantage of energy from the anti-Trump, gun control, and Me Too movements, as well as issues like Medicaid and the budget here in Iowa. Meanwhile, Republicans, who currently control the legislative and executive branches at both the state and federal levels, are touting what they consider major accomplishments under unified government. Here to help us analyze the campaign battles ahead, Republican Craig Robinson, founder and editor of the iowarepublican.com, and Democrat Pat Reinhard, founder and editor of iowastartingline.com. Gentlemen, welcome to the Iowa Press Table.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Across the table, Aaron Murphy is Des Moines Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprises, and Kay Henderson is News Director for Radio Iowa.
Pat, let's start with you.
Sure.
Real quickly, tell us what exactly is motivating the Democratic base that will turn out at the primary.
Well, so there's a lot of different things. I mean, for one, it's anti-Trump fervor, just sick and tired of everything that's happened. Some of it's regret over the 2016 election, people who didn't come out to vote then, and then they kind of saw what happened. So it's a number of those things. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, talk that Democrats can't just hope on anti-Trump sentiment to win, and there's definitely some truth in that. But I think, you know, we've seen through a number of different special elections, we've seen through marches and rallies, that the base is really riled up this year. And I think we're going to see much better turnout this time for Democrats.
Craig, on the Republican side, you don't have a statewide contest in the primary this time around.
Well, we do.
Talk about
it's
that.
For Secretary of Agriculture.
We can talk about the top of the ticket contest.
Sure.
What's motivating Republican voters who will be casting a ballot in June?
Yeah, I think this is a concern. I mean, the one advantage Republicans have is you have Governor Reynolds, who doesn't have a primary challenge now, who is new, likable, the party likes her, the activists, I think, are supportive of her. And so she's someone kind of new. Even though she's been on the scene, they get to know her at a more deeper level. And I think she's the type of candidate that people get excited about. So I do think that even though she's an unconventional, not your typical incumbent running for a reelection, I do think that she does have some power of incumbency that will help turn out Republicans.
How is the Trump trade situation playing in Republican circles?
Yeah, I think that... I think there's a lot of caution out there and some fear. And I think that Republicans give Trump a lot of slack and room to operate a little bit. And I think they understand that these are negotiations we're having with China, much like we had with North Korea. I mean, let's not forget, people thought we were going to go to war against North Korea, that something was going to happen. And what came out of this was actually talks between South Korea and North Korea, and now the United States probably. And so while there's a lot of noise going on between both sides, I think we kind of have to have some patience to see at the end of the day what actually comes of this. Do we have tariffs in place that are going to hurt our markets or not? I think it's a tough time to be an Iowa farmer,
Pat,
with all this going on.
Pat, they're part of the Democratic Party coalition that likes this.
Right. Yeah, in terms of just, you know, the political fallout of it, I mean, one of the big kind of open questions that we have for Democrats' prospects in 2018 is how frustrated are a lot of these rural Republicans and farmers going to be with the Trump administration? And are they going to link that frustration with down-ballot Republican candidates? You know, Annette Sweeney ended up winning that special election rather handily in some of those more rural counties. So there's, you know, it's not clear yet if aggravation with Trump actually means that some of these folks who, for various cultural reasons, are going to switch over to Democrats, or if they're just going to have less enthusiasm for Republicans.
Well, let's talk about some of those down ballot races. Sure. Craig, are David Young and Rod Blum vulnerable in this election?
Well, they're always vulnerable. I mean, they've been vulnerable since they were first elected. And so I think that Rod Blum is always at a little more risk than David Young is. But I think both will have significant challenges this fall and have their hands full. So these are tough districts to run in an environment where it's not going to favor the Republicans. They really got an advantage in the last general election with Trump running so strong in Iowa and all these congressional districts. Now there's no one at the top of the ballot. There's no one to help them out. So they're really on their own. So we'll see if they can withstand these challenges.
And how about Speaker Ryan's exit? His decision not to run creates a little bit of a leadership vacuum here for House Republicans. Does that impact those races at all?
I think it impacts it significantly. Look, when you're the Speaker of the House, you're the primary fundraiser for your party. You're the one who can show up in these districts and turn people out and say, look, this is why you need to be involved. He's stepping aside. So who fills that role? And is there anyone with big enough shoes to help these candidates? I mean, you gotta remember, John Boehner came and campaigned, I think, for both Blum and Young. Who's gonna do that this time around?
Yeah. Pat, how about for the Democrats in those two races?
Sure.
There's some competitive primaries in each. How are they feeling?
There are, and they're both rather interesting. I think, you know, most people figure that Abby Finkenauer is by far the front runner in the first congressional district. You know, Thomas Heckroth has enough money to go up with TV ads during the primary, and anytime you have enough funds to do TV ads, who knows? Maybe you strike gold with a really creative ad, as we've seen in the past with Iowa Republicans and Joni Ernst. But so you never know there. The third district's really interesting now that Teresa Greenfield's out of the mix. You have Pete D'Alessandro, who is, you know, has been endorsed by Bernie Sanders, is running a very left-leaning campaign that's trying to reactivate a lot of those Sanders voters who don't always, you know, pay attention to these congressional races. And then I think Cindy Axney has a good leg up now, considering she's the only female candidate in a three-way primary in a year where Democrats really want more.
Pat, did the Democrats lose their best candidate when Greenfield didn't make the ballot?
Yeah, some people certainly think so. she was favored by a lot of folks, not just some national Democratic organizations, but a lot of activists in the district. She was doing great, raising money. She had a wonderful, compelling story that had some rural background in it. I think she would have been good.
But if you can't get your petitions right, maybe you aren't the strongest candidate after all.
Yeah. Okay.
So. Speaking of petitions, you were involved in the Ron Corbett situation. Uh-huh. Why?
Why? Well, I think that when
let's specify the situation is
a challenge.
A challenge of his signatures, and that he didn't have enough and was not allowed on the ballot.
Look, so the challenge is really, this is the process you go through. So the candidates submit their petitions to the Secretary of State. They do a simple, it looks right, and then if they're challenged, then they look at them a little bit closer. So yes, I challenged Ron Corbett's petitions because there weren't that many of them. And if you look across the state the last year and a half as a candidate, he really hasn't motivated a base that you see turning out. I mean, when you're having a primary with, if Bob Vanderplaats is running or Steve Sukup was running, you could see these campaigns and the people supporting them. He didn't have it, and that's why we challenged.
We've got way too many questions and not enough time. Let's switch to the race for governor.
Sure.
Mr. Robinson, is Governor Reynolds vulnerable at all? Her job approval is okay. She's unknown to a lot of voters. She's never run for governor before. In a wave election year that's building up here for Democrats, could she be vulnerable?
Absolutely. I think this whole Republican ticket is vulnerable. I mean, look up and down these are people who assumed the job. They didn't run for statewide office and win and build these coalitions. And so while I think that Kim Reynolds has a lot of natural attributes that make her a fantastic statewide candidate, she doesn't have the previous, you know, experience of going out there and winning something with a group of people that you can count on again.
Mr. Reiner, give me your handicap of the Democratic primary. Six candidates, sure. Crowded.
Yeah. I mean, most people think that Fred Hubble and Nate Bolton are in the lead in the race and that they're the most likely to be able to break that 35%, which, again, you know, if no candidate hits 35%, then goes to a state convention. Kathy Glosson has enough funds and enough support amongst the left-leaning folks in the party that she could be able to come up at the end, and Andy McGuire's got enough money to go on TV. But, you know, it's largely seen as a race between Hubble and Bolton in a situation where it doesn't go to convention. If it does go to convention, Bolton's got a whole lot of delegates lined up for him. Glosson did well with that, and Hubble did as well.
What's your guess? Is somebody going to break 35% or this thing will go to convention?
I'd say no. I think it'd be really close, but I think just barely we'll get there. And part of it is that, you know, they all have their internal polls. If they see anyone getting close to 35%, then you would think the other Democrat candidates would start, you know, criticizing that person.
And do you expect anybody to fold their tent? I mean, they're on the ballot now, but
not at this point, because, I mean, you know, and it's getting almost too late to pull your name off the ballot. But, you know, if there's a contested convention, who knows? You know, everything's off the table at that point. You could see all kinds of interesting deals between the candidates, and anybody could come out of it.
Pat, you previously mentioned the Joni Ernst ad in 2014 that really cut through,
right.
The Make 'em Squeal ad. Isn't Kim Reynolds sort of running an Ernst-like campaign, yeah. And doesn't that worry Democrats?
Yes, it should. I don't know if it does with all of them. you know, a lot of times Democrats are so focused in on a lot of the policy issues, as they should, because real people are hurting out there. And we hit on, you know, Medicaid privatization and education funding and that type of thing. But at the end of the day, first, you know, voters care about the issues, but they first have to like you as a person and trust you as a person so that you can then get to that point. So, you know, my concern is, as it always is that, you know, if you run too, like, you know, polling heavy, message tested type of campaign and don't really introduce yourself as a human being first, then you got problems. And Reynolds has been doing a great job on building up her character.
I remember in 2007, Mike Huckabee was the first candidate among the PAC to sort of divorce himself from George W. Bush. Is Kim Reynolds in danger of being tied too closely to not only Donald Trump, but to her predecessor, and she hasn't made a name for herself yet?
Look, I don't think whatever you do, I don't think that the Democrat Party is going to let her distance herself one inch from the incumbent president. I think that your question's a little bit more interesting on her closeness to Branstad.
Right.
That, you know, this is really the Branstad administration continuing on. And I think that if it were me advising, which it's not, if it were me, I would have wanted a little bit more separation, a little bit different track down the road so you can distance. So if there are things in the past maybe you disagreed with.
Well, can you name one thing that she's done that has really struck a different path?
No, not really. I mean, this has been a continuation type of government. Everything's fine. We've got it under control in terms of the budget and all that stuff. So I think she has just kind of kept everything on the rails, which maybe that's the right decision. I don't know. I think she is interesting enough, and I think she is a very likable person that I think she has the ability, if she chooses to really blaze her own path and take things in her own direction if she wants to.
Well, one place she doesn't have an opportunity to do that now because of the Ron Corbett situation is a primary election. That's the ever-evolving question every election we go through. This is it better to have a primary or better to skate through? Does not having a primary, especially given that Governor Reynolds, as David said earlier, she hasn't run at the as the top of the ticket before in a statewide election, is that maybe a detriment to her where she could have sharpened her tools for the general election?
I don't think so. Look, I understand that she probably would be better prepared on a debate stage had she had a primary. But the type of campaign that Ron Corbett was going to run was already very negative. It's going to challenge her on everything. This is going to be a negative campaign. And at the end of the day, Ron Corbett was going to get, what, 20% of the vote, yeah, max? So I don't think it would have been a healthy exercise to go through. This allows her to roll out her campaign as she's doing now on TV, about talking about her story, her background, and it gives her the space to do it.
Mr. Reiner, same question to you. What is Kim Reynolds helped or hurt by the fact she doesn't have a primary?
I think probably helped because, you know, the messaging that Corbett was running, which was a lot of, like, fiscal mismanagement type stuff, those are the same kind of arguments the Democrats are making. So it wasn't too much like, I'm more conservative or that kind of thing, and really it's not. But so it's I think it's helpful that she doesn't have to deal with that.
Lots of interesting legislative races. Let's switch to that topic. Pat, in the Senate, was the resignation of Senate Republican leader Bill Dix actually a gift to Republicans?
Well,
so that issue of sexual harassment is sort of off the table.
I mean, I could see that you could argue that, you know, it's a lot harder, obviously, to run ads against Republican Senate candidates that, you know, tying them to Bill Dix. But I think you still can. And even if you don't, it's obvious that there's still kind of lingering issues there. The culture has not completely changed, I don't believe, in the Senate. And then, you know, in general, like, you know, you have a leader like that leave, all of his fundraising connections leave. Not all of them. The other folks will pick it up to some. But it's more chaos. It just develops this idea of chaos around the Republican Party.
But isn't the House the more focused attention place for Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, the House is where Democrats have a much better shot just of, you know, because all the seats are up, whereas in the Senate, only half of them are up, and there's only maybe about three real good pickup opportunities in the Senate. So, you know, and you know, in the House, there's a lot of suburban districts that are on the ballot where we've been seeing this big shift towards Democrats under Trump that looks good.
Craig, on the Republican side, you had a lot of incumbents in the House say, gosh, I don't want to run again. What does that tell you?
I think it tells you that there's going to be a difficult election year coming up. You know, and they've been in power. They've had the majority now for a while. And a lot of these people have been there for quite a while. And so I do think that the House is where you're going to see the most change go on. I actually think the Senate, surprisingly for Republicans, looks at, you could pick up seats. You could lose control of the Iowa House if you're Republican, but you could gain seats in the state Senate with just the districts that are up and the candidates that they've recruited. The Senate's actually done a lot of good work despite all the chaos that's gone on. They're well prepared. The House is where you have so many retirements, and how many of these campaigns do you have the money to play in to hold those seats?
You know, one thing I wanted to ask, we hear a lot of talk about Congress and the fact that in an off-year presidential election, seats in the U.S. House will often be picked up by the party that does not hold the White House. What's the take on the Iowa legislature? Is there any correlation between victories or defeats in the Iowa legislature in a year when the party is holds the White House?
Well, it's not as turbulent as I think Congress is. If you go back in 2008 when Christopher Rance was Speaker, trying to regain control of the House, I think they lost winning back the majority by only 800 votes statewide. These are smaller districts where you can really, if you recruit well and turn out your people, you can make a big
difference. So it's the quality of the candidate that's going to be counted.
So who are Republicans worried about in the House, Craig, and if they're going to keep their majority, whether it's candidates or kinds of districts, who are they worried about protecting?
Look, I think the districts you worry about are urban. You know, when you have these Windsor Heights, West Des Moines districts that where the districts are already kind of trending away from you in terms of voter registration. And I think you have this, you know, kind of anti-Trump movement. It's a little bit easier to tap into in these more urban centers where I think the rural seats, I think you can still go out there, do your work and win them.
So, for example, the kind of district that Chris Hagenow is moving out of.
Exactly.
Just coincidentally, you know.
There are teacher protests in states like West Virginia and Oklahoma, which are overwhelmingly led by Republican legislators. And, you know, last year, the Republican-led legislature here passed a rollback of collective bargaining rights. Pat, the legislators in the Senate and the House, Jason Schultz in the Senate and Stephen Holt in the House, who managed those bills, do not have Democratic opponents. How much of an animating issue is it if you can't get somebody to step forward as a Democrat to challenge them?
Yeah, those are kind of unique circumstances because, well, at least with Schultz, it's deep Western Iowa, and Democrats have filled more seats than almost ever. But you are right that, you know, there's a lot of backlash still happening with the collective bargaining issue. There's a lot of teachers who are much more excited and ready to go vote, and I think you're going to see a big shift in how they vote to pretty much unanimously Democrat in some of these races.
Let's look at the big picture. a little bit. Is Iowa, and I'll start with you, Mr. Reinhardt, is Iowa becoming a more Republican state? And I ask that question because of, you look at the size of Trump's margin. I mean, he ran better here than he did in Texas. Mm-hmm. You look at the Iowa electorate, older, rural, white. Only 28% of Iowans have college degrees. I've just given you the profile of a Trump voter. So my question to you is, demographically, isn't Iowa becoming a more Republican state?
Well, and this was a very big concern for the party immediately after 2016. There was a lot of folks, and me to a certain extent, included, as, like, are we just a red state now? You know, have we moved into kind of a Kansas type situation? But I think, you know, the encouraging things for Democrats is a lot of the special elections in these during this last year and a half since Trump was elected. And Democrats are improving on the margins by 30 points. In this last one, it was 14 points. And that's encouraging. We would, you know, we'd just be happy if we get back to a place where the state's competitive statewide and we have a fair chance.
I want to ask about that, Pat. The Democrats are excited by the special elections that you've noted. The margins are changing. They're performing better in districts compared to 2016. But at the same time, they have not flipped any of those seats yet. And it's also setting a baseline of 2016 and Hillary Clinton's performance here, where she did not do well compared to other candidates here in Iowa. Are the Democrats kind of in danger in creating some false hope here by using those margins?
Well, I mean, look, there's always a number of things that go into special election results that aren't exactly, you know, transferable. But part of the thing is just it's been all the special elections have just happened to be held in largely safe seats for other parties. So there just wasn't really a great chance to actually flip one. But, you know, we'd much rather have, you know, 30-point shifts to Democrats than the opposite. So it's still encouraging.
It's also true that close only counts in hand grenades horseshoes, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Craig, I want to go back to the question. Yeah. Is Iowa becoming more Republican?
I think it is becoming more Republican, but I think we have to have some caution here. I think that when you look at Trump and his kind of populist nature and his message to those blue-collar workers, I think that's how you make this a red state. The problem is I'm not seeing the policies from the legislature to really mirror that. And so if Republicans really want to control the state, I think some of their decisions on what they went after is kind of the core old Republican issues, nothing that really mirrored what Trump's message was to play off that and to kind of hold those people.
Democrats have run well with millennials around the country. But don't the Democrats hurt in this state because so many college-educated young people who would be voting Democratic if they stayed are leaving the state. So, you know, it's like you're washing out the Democratic electorate.
And it's not just that. It's we consolidate those people, too. I mean, look, I grew up in rural Iowa. You know, where do I live today? I live in Ankeny. I mean, that's what's happening. There's a shift where you go to college and then you go get a job and you're living in a metro area, or my brother lives in Sacramento. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, it's this rural Iowa is a big issue, I think, for both parties coming forward. But you got to have a message that applies not only in metropolitan areas, but also rural Iowa.
Speaking of rural Iowa, you have an unusual circumstance where the only statewide primary for Republicans is among a huge group that want to be the next ag secretary, one of whom was appointed. Is that thing going to get decided in the June primary, or will there be a convention?
Yeah, I think that we're kind of staring at a convention if you had to look at it today. I mean, this is a race that, you know, I think ag interest groups are interested and involved in, but I don't think any of the candidates have kind of raised the bar to make people regular voters. And this is going to be the primary driver of primary turnout.
So why are these people running? Do they consider this a stepping stone?
Look, I think the ag secretary job in Iowa is a great job. And obviously, I mean, there are four really good people running for it. And I think this is where, you know, for me personally, I look at whoever I want someone in that spot who I think can help the Republican ticket statewide, who can go out there in a general election and talk to these rural people.
And Mr. Reiner, does it really matter who the Secretary of Agriculture is politically?
I mean, I don't know. Politically, not too much, as opposed to, you know, of folks who may end up raising up.
I want to go back to this question of Iowa. Is it becoming more Democratic or Republican? What do you make of what do the Democrats have to do to their message to start reaching out to the electorates that is there, older, whiter? Yeah. What do they do?
I think it's a return to more economic-based messaging and trying to distance yourself from some of the national movements that we see and some of the national problems that Democrats have. It's largely winning back those type of blue-collar voters who voted for Democrats because they thought they'd have a good wage out of it.
Less than a minute.
Yeah, we got about 30 seconds left. Real quick, Pat, let's look ahead to 2020 in the sure. little time we have left. What Democrats are you already seeing or looking forward to seeing coming out?
Well, there's a lot of them. There's a whole lot of them.
More than 30 seconds worth, I'm sure.
Yeah, sorry. One thing I mentioned earlier is before here was that, you know, there's a lot of these kind of middle-aged white Democrats coming out to the state. We had Steve Bullock and Eric Swalwell and John Delaney come in. It's going to be interesting to see how they differentiate themselves to actually stand out in what could be a field of 15, 20 Democrats.
Craig, are we going to see a Republican challenger to President Trump?
I don't think so.
And I have to leave it at
That's
that.
Fine.
We got a lot of time in the next 3 years to talk about President. We'll have you back to talk about that. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Iowa Press at our usual times, 7:30 Friday night and Sunday at noon on our main IPTV channel, with a rebroadcast at 8:30 Saturday morning on our .3 World channel. So for all of us here at Iowa Public Television, I'm David Yepsen, and thanks for joining us today.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation, the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
I'm a dad.
I am a mom.
I'm a kid.
I'm a kid at heart.
I'm a banker.
I'm an Iowa banker.
No matter who you are, there is an Iowa banker who is ready to help you get where you want to go. Iowa Bankers, allowing you to discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks.